From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wittakuswara and Marketplace Correspondent Nancy Marshall-Genzer. Welcome, Nancy and Patsy.
Happy to be here.
Well, here are this week's issues. Ukraine's defense minister said that Patriot air defense systems have arrived in the country. Ukrainian officials long lobbied allies to provide the advanced weapons that are capable of shooting down enemy missiles. And Ukrainian forces spent several months training in the U.S. and Europe to use the systems. Russian President Vladimir Putin met with his commanders in two regions of Ukraine that Moscow claims to have annexed. Images of the Russian president's trip to Ukraine offered a counterpoint to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's frequent visits to his country's troops. A Russian court refused to release U.S. journalist Evan Gershkovich from jail while he awaits trial on accusations that he spied on Russia while on a reporting assignment last month. Vladimir Kara-Murza, a prominent Russian human rights advocate and Kremlin critic, has been sentenced to 25 years in prison after publicly condemning Moscow's war in Ukraine. The sentencing was condemned as politically motivated and draconian by the international community. Sudan's military and the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, paramilitary group, are engaged in fierce fighting in the capital Khartoum and elsewhere in the country, raising fears of a civil war. A spokesperson confirmed to VOA that the U.S. State Department established a special task force to deal with the crisis in Sudan. Here in the U.S., Fox News Media and Dominion Voting Systems agreed to a blockbuster $787.5 million settlement over the network's coverage of former President Trump's false claims of voter fraud in the 2020 election. On Capitol Hill, House Republicans' go-it-alone debt limit bill pairs a debt ceiling increase expected to last into next year with what Speaker Kevin McCarthy said would be about $4.5 trillion in savings generated in part by cutting Biden administration priorities. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. With the Patriot missile defense systems from Western allies now in Ukraine, a wish list fulfilled for the country, what direction will these take Russia's war on Ukraine?
Yeah, so this is definitely, as you said, something that the Ukrainians have been asking for a long time. I think their defense minister tweeted that he's been asking it for the past 2 years, even before the start of the invasion. This system that is the best in the world for its purpose, which is knocking down cruise missiles and advanced aircrafts, but it really isn't a silver bullet. That's what military analysts have told me, because this Patriot battery has a strike range of roughly 20 to 100 miles, so it won't cover the entire country, obviously, but it can cover a certain region or city or, you know, important infrastructure. And it's also very expensive to use because the missiles that accompany the Patriots that shoots down the incoming missiles from Russia is about $4 million each. So much more expensive than the missiles from HIMARS, more expensive than the Stingers missiles. So obviously, the Ukrainians must be very judicious in how they use this. And the Russians have appeared to have this strategy of using cheap Iranian drones to attack civilian targets. And so it really is, you know, an exercise and military strategy in terms of how they use this most effectively. So yes, this is something that the Ukrainians have been wanting for, asking for a long time. They're very happy with the fact that it has arrived. They were trained very quickly, the Ukrainian soldiers, on this system. But again, it's not something that will change the course of the war in like a silver bullet manner.
Absolutely. And, you know, of course, at $4 million apiece, the Ukrainians aren't going to want to use the Patriots against those Iranian drones that apparently Russia has been buying and using in Ukraine. But it could help shoot down some of the missiles that have been aimed at Ukraine's power grid and residential areas. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken just announced another package of aid for Ukraine this week. He called it the 36th drawdown of U.S. arms and equipment. It's valued at up to $325 million. And this is more ammunition for those HIMARS and utility rounds, anti-armor systems, small arms. So the Biden administration so far is continuing to help Ukraine in lots of ways.
And in the meantime, Russian President Vladimir Putin met with his commanders in two regions of Ukraine that Moscow claims to have annexed. One analyst says that Putin was attempting to demonstrate that he's not isolated, quote, in a bunker, unquote, by meeting with commanders. Are you getting reports on the state of his troopers at this time, and are they ready for a counteroffensive?
I don't particularly focus on the granular details of what's happening on the ground, but certainly the White House is responding to Putin's visit to these areas of Ukraine that Russia occupies as a political stunt, essentially. Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House press secretary, said yesterday that this seems to be a ploy that shows that Russia is not doing as well as they think they are. This is just an effort to garner support from the Russian population. So the White House is really dismissing with their own kind of counter messaging on this issue.
And, you know, it's interesting that China is denying reports that its drones have been used by Russia against Ukraine. While China may be helping Russia secretly, it's definitely not saying anything to support Russia in public. So that certainly can't help Russia's cause.
And that's definitely something that I'm looking at in the coming weeks, because we know that this week, Russian and Chinese military defense officials have met, and they've basically signed on to this initiative that's designed to, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, to show the world the strength of their strategic military cooperation. And so what this means in the future, that's a big question. There's also reporting by the New York Times that shows that China is expanding its nuclear arsenal with help from Russia using Russian materials. Really is something important to look at, I think, in terms of just how tactical or strategic this growing cooperation and defense ties between the two countries.
Yes, and in another aspect, Russia's use of the court system to imprison critics and journalists, such as the U.S. journalist Evan Gershkovich and the human rights advocate Vladimir Kara-Murza. It appears to be part of Putin's war effort, sending a message to the international community not to criticize the Kremlin. So how is the international community responding to this treatment of journalists and human rights advocates? Will they stay out of Russia and those that are there get out of Russia?
Well, the State Department issued a statement saying that it has determined that Gershkovich was wrongfully detained in Russia. It says journalism is not a crime, condemning what it called the Kremlin's continued repression of independent voices. It says it will support Gershkovich and his family. And there's only so much the U.S. can do here, especially since Gershkovich is not the only American being held in Russia. So far, they're issuing some pretty strong statements. They're saying the charges against Gershkovich are baseless, calling on Russia to release him. But it's not clear what else the U.S. is doing at this point.
Yeah, so it's not just Gershkovich in Russia. I think we have to remember that there's a record number of journalists that were imprisoned all over the world. The Committee to Protect Journalists gives out this report at the end of every year. And in 2022, they are saying that there were 363 journalists detained in more than 30 countries last year. And the highest number of those detainees were in Iran, China, Myanmar. I think Russia comes in at either fifth or sixth or something like that. So this is clearly a problem in terms of freedom of the press around the world. And specifically on the case of Evan, this is also notable because this is the first time that Russia has been detaining a U.S. journalist or accusing a U.S. journalist of espionage since the Soviet era.
And of course, it's not just journalists. There's Paul Whelan. He's been held in Russia since 2018. He's a businessman and former U.S. Marine, also charged with espionage and convicted of espionage in 2020. The U.S. also says he's wrongfully detained. His brother went on ABC this week and said that Paul Whelan feels as though the U.S. government has abandoned him, and he is feeling less hopeful now because another American has been detained, and he always seems to be the one who's left in Russia after other Americans are released.
Yes, notably Brittany Griner, the woman basketball star. And I think you're right, Kim. You mentioned that it's not just journalists, but also other human rights advocate and Kremlin critic. I mean, certainly the Kremlin has been ramping up efforts to stifle dissent since the beginning of the war. I believe they passed this law to punish anyone publishing information that are deemed false about the invasion. This came just days after the Ukrainian invasion. And of course, a lot of Russian activists, including, as you mentioned, Vladimir Kara-Murza, is in detention, as well as Alexei Navalny, the most prominent opposition figure in Russia, who's right now serving, I believe, 11 or 12 year long sentence at the penal colony.
Yes, very disturbing trend. And you all brought out a very good point that it is not just Russia, it's just Russia lately, but this has been going on for years around the world with suppressing journalists and human rights advocates. We're going to move over now to Sudan. VOA reports airstrikes and explosions hammered Sudan's capital Wednesday after the failure of a U.S.-brokered ceasefire between the army and paramilitary forces, forcing residents to stay hunkered down and prompting many countries to evacuate their citizens. How is the U.S. responding now to this continued fighting?
Well, the White House has condemned in the strongest terms. That's what White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre reiterated yesterday. The State Department's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, has made a personal call to both of the generals, warring parties, asking them to cease fire immediately without condition. But there's really not much that they can do, what the U.S. can do in terms of, you know, what kind of consequences if these warring parties do not listen. And the stakes are really high because, you know, this is a region that's obviously surrounded by neighbors that have experienced conflict in the past few years. There's the Central African Republic, Ethiopia, Libya, South Sudan. And there's a growing risk of a proxy war by other regional powers, you know, UAE, Saudi Arabia. So it's a very troubled region that has had a lot of violent conflict. And, you know, these countries have rebels on various payrolls and various interests. So there's a real danger of this conflict spilling out, especially if there are outside actors like, you know, the Wagner group from Russia that has a lot of activities in the Sahel region. All of these other outside forces could see an opportunity in jumping into the conflict and makes it turning it into a much more volatile and dangerous situation.
And, you know, there's not a whole lot the U.S. can do logistically to get its citizens out of Sudan at this point. There's been a lot of fighting around the airport and reports of airplanes, you know, on fire. And so it would be hard to land a plane there right now. There have been calls for a ceasefire. There have been ceasefires that haven't really held. And so now supplies, food is getting short, and the civilians are just hunkered down in their homes, worried about running out of food and water. And it's, as I say, very hard for any plane loaded with supplies to land at Khartoum International Airport right now.
Yeah, that's a very good point, is Sudan was already in a precarious humanitarian situation, and a lot of humanitarian agencies have been suspended there. And as you pointed out, residents are hunkered down. Some have been killed. Families are in need of food and shelter. So it could turn into a really dire humanitarian situation if this fighting continues.
Yeah, and Doctors Without Borders says that hospitals are running out of food and don't have power, and many aren't even open. This is just, as you say, a really dire situation. The World Health Organization says at least 296 people have been killed, more than 3,000 injured. And Doctors Without Borders also says that half of hospitals have been out of action. Their warehouses were broken into and they haven't been able to get over to their warehouses to see what was taken. But everybody is struggling.
Well, it's time now for a quick break, and when we return, Fox News Media and Dominion Voting Systems reach an agreement following a lengthy legal battle over a defamation lawsuit surrounding the 2020 presidential election. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Zwara and Marketplace Correspondent Nancy Marshall-Genzer. Well, Dominion Voting Systems filed a $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit against Fox News Media in March 2021. And just to give our audience a little context to this issue, the lawsuit stemmed from coverage of the post-2020 presidential election, which had become media fodder, with news outlets closely watching the outcome of the highly publicized legal battle. Then President Trump and his allies fiercely challenged Joe Biden's victory in the weeks following the election, and some of them, including members of his legal team, made false and unsubstantiated claims against Dominion Voting Systems. Nancy, was this settlement a smart move for Dominion from a business perspective?
Seems to be. I mean, it's a whole lot of money, almost $800 million, although Fox did not have to issue any kind of on-air retraction or apology. But the thing is, Dominion says that the outcome of the case really helps them gain some momentum in going into a slew of other lawsuits that they've been filing. I mean, Dominion is suing Newsmax, which is another right-wing media organization. They're suing some individuals, including Rudy Giuliani, Trump's former lawyer. So this gives Dominion's lawyers a lot of ammunition going into those cases.
Yes, I think what is really interesting, as Nancy pointed out, is the fact that Fox News does not need to apologize, right? And so I took a peek at their website and just searched Dominion, and it was buried under their media column. And, you know, the coverage of the settlement was very, let's say, friendly towards Fox interests. So essentially, even though they did have to pay this massive, massive amount, I believe it's the biggest settlement in a defamation case, but they don't have to tell their viewers that they were wrong. They didn't have to tell their viewers that they essentially lied about this very important system in a very important election, and this whole narrative of the big lie, as Democrats like to call it, in terms of saying that President Trump won the election and President Biden stole the election from Trump. That narrative still stands, and in some cases is still being spread out by Fox News personalities, when in fact it was clear from the discovery process of this whole lawsuit that they were emailing and texting each other back and forth, indicating that they knew that this was a lie, and yet they publicized it anyway. So I thought that that was a really fascinating thing to study about this case.
Yes, and also Fox has never come close to paying this amount of money before in any kind of litigation. So will they pay this?
At this point, they haven't said anything about appealing, and they could be paying a whole lot more. They're facing more lawsuits. There's one company called Smartmatic. It's another electronic voting systems company. It is suing Fox News for $2.7 billion in damages. And they say that Fox lied about Smartmatic technology in order to boost its ratings. And the ironic thing here is that Smartmatic says its technology was only used in Los Angeles County, which President Biden won in a landslide. So assuming that's true, it would be very hard for Fox to prove that Smartmatic somehow orchestrated falsifying election results across the country when it was only used in Los Angeles.
Very interesting. Well, we'll move on to our last topic. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and Republicans submitted a proposed debt ceiling increase. The bill, called the Limit Save Grow Act, aims to raise the debt limit by $1.5 trillion or through March 31st, 2024, whichever comes first. So is this bill going to be passed?
Well, it might pass the House, but McCarthy has a very small margin, and Republicans in the House are not exactly unified. It's kind of like herding cats. But even if this passes the House, it's not going to pass in the Democrat-controlled Senate. But I think what McCarthy is trying to do here is to come out first out of the gate in the debate, get his points across first, and then other people will have to respond to him. The one thing that's encouraging here is that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, and President Biden have both negotiated debt limit either suspensions or increases before. They were both involved in the very close call. The U.S. came very close to defaulting in 2011, but Biden and McConnell stepped back from the brink then and hopefully learned their lesson.
Well, the White House is essentially coming out with this very strong stance of saying from the beginning, nope, we're not negotiating. This is something of a formality. This is something that's a congressional responsibility. They should do it. They've done it many, many times throughout the past 50 years or so, and there's no reason that this should be a fight. So I think, as you mentioned, Nancy, President Biden has been involved in this kind of debt ceiling brinkmanship many times throughout the past 20 years, including in 2011 and 2015. And I believe that you and I have covered this issue, and it seems like Groundhog Day, right? Like every few years, yes, we're discovering this whole situation again, where again, we have to explain to our viewers, what is a debt ceiling? Why is it important? Why are Republicans saying no to this? And, you know, it seems like it's just a fight that happens in Congress over and over and over again, particularly when it's under control of the Republican Party. So this is a strategy that President Biden has settled on in saying that, nope, we're not going to negotiate. If the country's credibility tanks, it will be on the Republicans. If the country's economy is faltering, it will be on the Republicans. And so he's really playing hardball on this issue.
This is very expensive brinksmanship, because what happened in 2011 when the U.S. came so close to defaulting, that is not paying our debts because our debt limit wasn't raised or suspended in time. Standard & Poor's, which is a credit rating agency, downgraded the U.S. credit rating, and that meant the U.S. had to pay more to borrow. And in fact, the Government Accountability Office says in fiscal 2011, the U.S. paid about $1 billion more to borrow money. And people that I have talked with who followed this very closely say the U.S. is already paying more to borrow now as we get closer to this summer, when we could run out of money to pay our bills if the debt limit isn't raised or suspended.
What does that mean for Americans if it isn't raised or suspended?
I don't even want to think about that. We would default on our debt. A lot of people compare this to a credit card. But the thing is, these are debts that the U.S. Congress has already approved. The money has already been spent. So this is like the U.S. saying, yeah, we spent this money, but we're not going to pay it. It's like you're sitting in a restaurant, you've had a wonderful meal, and the bill comes and you duck out and you run away without paying. And obviously, if you do that, people aren't going to trust you, and you'll have to pay a lot more to borrow money.
Not to mention the programs that depend on the continuity of funds from the government, you know, everything from Social Security to Medicare to emergency programs. If there's a hurricane, all of these become endangered when there's no continuity of government funding. And in fact, I think, I don't know, Kim, you and I have probably experienced the whole threat of not getting paid. Eventually, that was, of course, paid retroactively. But, you know, this is a very, very disruptive brinkmanship that has potentially catastrophic economic impact on not just the U.S., but also around the world.
Yeah, and people who say it would be no big deal for the U.S. default say, oh, we could just pick and choose what bills to pay. We would pay senior citizens Social Security. We would pay the salaries of our troops. But the thing is, I talked to one senior advisor at the Government Accountability Office, and she said there's no way Treasury can do that. Their computers are just not configured to do that.
It's a very serious situation. Well, it's time now to find out what is weighing on the minds of our panelists this week. So, Patsy, what is weighing on your mind?
Oh, I am waiting for a Friday. That is when the Supreme Court will give their decision on the abortion pill. This is a drug that has been used for many years in the U.S. to provide abortion for women in their pregnancy up to 10 weeks, I believe. But suddenly a judge in Texas, based on a law case pushed forth by the pro-abortionist movement, is saying that, nope, we're not going to use this drug anymore because the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, this is the agency that determines what drug is safe or not for the market, they were wrong. So that decision by the judge kind of just started this whole big legal fight about this abortion pill. And it was brought up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will have given themselves at least until Friday to consider whether to allow these other restrictions on this drug to take effect.
Thank you. And Nancy,
You know, Kim, I've been thinking about our healthcare system and the lack of support for long-term care. You know that I've been taking leave to care for my father, who's on hospice, and we are getting very little support from Medicare. None of us live close by, so we're rotating in and out every 2 to 3 weeks, and my leave will be used up, and we're thinking, we don't want them to go into a nursing home. What do we do? And all I can think of is, I hope other countries have a better system than we do, because our system just relies on the family to provide in-home care.
Thank you for both of those thoughts, and we will close the show on those notes. My thanks to our panelists, VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Zwara and Marketplace Correspondent Nancy Marshall-Genzer. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.